This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for April 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we'll hear from Jamal May.
It is nothing compared to that moment when I eat the dark.
Anna Maria Hong.
I, too, arose from the unthinkable.
And then we'll talk with Marjorie Perloff about her advice for poets.
Don't think you have the view that you are the sage who knows, you know, what the meaning of life is, and be so pompous about it.
For prose this month, we have an essay by Christina Pugh on the disappearance of what she calls nonconformism in poetry. And also, instead of the usual review with a single writer giving his or her take on recent books, we're trying to do something a little bit different this month.
We have an exchange of three poets, Gwyneth Lewis, Michael Lista, and Angie Malenko, about books by Carmine Starnino, Glenn Maxwell, and Mary Ruffel.
For poetry this month, we have new work from Dean Young, Jane Hirschfield, Randall Mann, and others. Don, was there anything in particular you wanted to highlight this month?
Well, speaking of Gwyneth Lewis, we have a poem of hers that I quite liked, called Fooled Me for Years with the Wrong Pronouns. You made me cry in cruel stations, so I missed many trains. You married others in plausible buildings. The subsequent son became my boss. You promised me nothing but blame me for doubting when who wouldn't. If I knew how to please you, who have found out my faults. In dreams I'm wild with guilt. Have pity, kill it. Then, when I've lost all hope, kiss me again, your mouth so open, I'd give anything for one more night that I go without thought. Don't bite. No, mark me. My husband already knows exactly what owns me.
Who's that you?
Well, this is great because there is a kind of pronoun problem in contemporary poetry. Almost every poem you're liable to look at has, obviously, the usual suspects in it. And it takes a deft poet to make something out of those pronouns. Otherwise, it's just sort of, I did this, I did that, or my favorite, the very generic you that's in so many poems. You did this, you did that. So this poem turns that to its own advantage in a way.
You think it's a love poem. It is a love poem in a way. And then it surprises you at the end with the husband, so that you think it's an affair, and it is an affair in the way. But I think it's probably about the muse. At least it's one way of reading it, that it's a poem about being so devoted to one thing that you're not able to have the devotion that someone might expect in other areas. My husband knows what owns me.
Right.
It's not another man. It's art.
Yeah.
You married others in plausible buildings. The subsequent son, the art, became my boss.
Right. Well, the language is her boss, and the language is filled with these pronouns, and it's hard to pin down who or what possesses you to write. And yet at the same time, you know, the poet has a real sensual life. So this kind of is the nexus of where the language and real life meet and maybe kiss.
Yeah, let me read the poem immediately after that one in the issue. It's one that particularly struck me by a poet named J.T. Barbarese reading Primo Levi off Columbus Circle. Rereading him in Bouchon past noon, it is mobbed midtown, like an ant farm seen through painkillers. God, what a bust it's all been. Capitalism, communism, feminism, this lust to liberate. Che should have stayed in medicine. The girls here admit they can't wait to marry and get to the alimony before they hit 30. The men, heads skinned like lager inmates, know only the revolutions and diets and spinning classes. Still, one table away, these two, with gnarled and pretzeled hands, seem unhappy in the old way. Reminds me of Freud's normal unhappiness, you know, aspiring for normal unhappiness. There's a lot of things to love about this. One is the clever rhymes all the way through, the men and revolutions and wait and liberate, away and way and midtown and bin. And another's the really striking metaphorical energy, like an ant farm seen through painkillers. He sees a crowd in New York that way. And then I just love the cleverness. He mentions Che, and then you get revolutions, and the line breaks, and it's instead of revolutions that we think of, it's in diets and spinning classes, and the way that our lives have sort of devolved from that kind of intensity. And then he ends with this image of normal happiness, but he calls him unhappy in the old way. And you understand why it's called Reading Primo Levi, because Primo Levi wrote those books that were, in ways, triumphs of his experience in the Holocaust. But in the end, the Holocaust got him. You know, he couldn't overcome that depression and sadness.
It's funny, seeming unhappy in the old way. It's, you know, the old country. I just, you know, where Primo Levi, and for that matter, Columbus came from, that intersection of our so-called new world and the old world, the old ways, is sort of overwhelming. I mean, you can just see when you're in a mob, who are all these people? What kind of freedom do we all have together? It can be dismaying, as Primo Levi seems to have been dismayed. Even Columbus Circle does not resemble anything like a new free world.
Yeah.
Columbus himself being so fraught here. And that sort of lively pessimism here.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
It proposes another world in which Che was only able to help people by being a doctor, which he had been. But it's also wry enough to overcome, I think, a little, maybe a little tiny bit, some of its pessimism.
Yeah.
I mean, there wouldn't be any point
in the poem otherwise.
Right.
Jamal May is a poet from Detroit with many years of experience in poetry slams. It's his first appearance in the magazine, and his book will be published later this year by Alice James Books.
His book is called Hum, and some of the poems, instead of being, say, odes to or songs for somebody or something, are hums.
I wrote a poem called Hum for the Hammer. The idea of it was to be a song towards an inanimate object. And the idea of it being a hum came about because I thought of it as like a hymn, but not quite a hymn. So hum is the hum of song, but it's the hum of machinery. It's the hum of vibration, of breathing, etc.
His poem in the April issue is called Hum for the Bolt.
And by bolt, we should say that he's talking first about a bolt of cloth and then also about several other meanings of the word, as you'll hear when you hear the poem. Here's Jamal May reading Hum for the Bolt.
It could, of course, be silk. 50 yards or so of the next closest thing to water to the touch. Or it could just as easily be a shaft of wood crumpling a man struck between Spalder and Helm. But now, with the rain making a noisy erasure of this town, it is the flash that arrives and leaves at nearly the same moment. It's what I want to be in this moment, in this doorway, because as much as I'd love to be the silk shimmer against the curve of anyone's arm, as brutal and impeccable as it be to soar from a crossbow with a whistle and have a man switch off upon my arrival, it is nothing compared to that moment when I eat the dark, draw shadows in quick strokes across wall, and start a tongue counting down to thunder, that counting that says, I am this far. I am this close.
I love that ending. In quick strokes across the wall and start a tongue counting down to thunder. Of course, he's talking about when you see the lightning and then you wait for thunder. But he's also talking about a sexual experience here, right? An intimate experience. And he combines those two wonderfully.
Yeah, the bolt, it's funny. I guess it's the bolt of fabric, the thunderbolt. It's so sensual. It combines unlikely things, which is, the essence of the sensual, sort of the surprise or the weird or unexpected electric feel of something.
Yeah, and two of those unlikely things are the, it's funny, picking up on the poem we just talked about, are the past and the present, because he uses words like Spalder and Helm. And the Spalder is a shoulder plate for a suit of armor, in a way. And the helm is a word for helmet. It means other things, but I think here he means helmet by it. And so this bolt of lightning here is striking a man who's in armor, hitting a long time ago, right? And then the bolt reaches all the way right into this moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment, too. It's romantic in the best way. You know, he's in the doorway, and he wants to love to be the silk shimmer against the curve of anyone's arm. The sort of loneliness and yearning is gorgeous here, but it doesn't lapse into anything sentimental and goopy. You know, as soon as you get into that Auden-like thing about the curve of anyone's arm, you know, he says, as brutable and impeccable as it be to soar from a crossbow with a whistle and have a man switch off upon my arrival.
I.e. die.
Yeah. Some killer.
Yeah. This is also Anna Maria Hong's first appearance in the magazine, and we have two of her poems in the issue.
Anna Maria Hong teaches creative writing at the UCLA Extension Writers Program, and she's the editor of an anthology of fiction and memoir called Growing Up Asian American.
Her poem Pluralisms is a lyrical meditation on what it means to be seen as different, and it draws on the story of Cyclops from the Odyssey. Both of these poems that we're going to hear are what you'd call difficult poems. There's no way around it, and they're challenging if you're just hearing them for the first time. One way to think of the poems is, first of all, just these wonderful constructions of sound. They're intoxicating in their sound, and to sort of give yourself over to this. In this poem, Pluralisms, Polyphemus is the Cyclops, and she says, by way of Redon, which is the painter Odilon Redon. Here is Anna Maria Hong reading Pluralisms.
To challenge sleep, to go against the one-eyed god of victimhood, Polyphemus by way of Redon rising, open eye ripe with stupid gazing, how dare you look at me? Plural tense, now and then, to bed and back again, and one more war. The oral rinse of moral sense can lift the fence of expectation, expand the dome of tolerance. I too arose from the unthinkable, used to nobody responding, loud as circumstance.
The nobody in the poem is from the story, you know, where Polyphemus, the Cyclops, he keeps eating Odysseus's men. And at one point, the Cyclops says, who's there? Who's there? And Odysseus says, nobody, which is what his name translates to. He's nobody.
That's interesting. I remember when we first got this poem, I was struck by these last lines and struck enough to keep the poem and for us to, you know, we kept thinking about it because for me, it inevitably has a kind of religious connotation. I too arose from the unthinkable. Polyphemus comes from the unthinkable. Used to nobody, responding loud as circumstance. Now, there's a famous line by the mystic Meister Eckhart, the eye with which I see God is the eye with which God sees me. So that the notion is that the extent to which you give yourself over reality is the extent to which God communicates back to you. Here, this undercuts that in a very beautiful way. You could say used to God responding loud as circumstance, but in fact, it's used to nobody responding loud. What you see is what you get, right?
Right.
And I quite like that. I think it's a stark, unintentional probably, but reworking mm-hmm. of that mystical notion. And I remember thinking of that and thinking, well, maybe the poem's not about that, but being drawn in for that reason and also drawn in just because of those amazing sounds,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I think, too, the sounds sort of move things along, but the story there is that pain of the stupid gazing. Not only pain, but the literal danger of it, so that if you are perceived to be different, then being stared at in that way does a kind of violence. And in the poem it says, how dare you look at me, mm-hmm. plural tense, now and then, to bed and back again in one more war. I mean, all the different forums that there are for this being seen in a certain way, but it does create what the poem calls a fence of expectation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's extremely compact and complicated, but it also addresses what she calls the dome of tolerance, which makes it feel like it's high above, maybe even movable. So these interactions, the pluralisms, really are challenging. But at the same time, it sort of addresses the idea of victimhood, you know, to challenge sleep, to go against the one-eyed god of victimhood. So
right.
That there's who's a victim and how you're being victimized is more complicated than you might just think from superficial versions of identity yeah. politics.
Well, tone is important here because you mentioned the Homeric Polyphemus, but I think this is actually talking more about the Ovid. Mm-hmm. That's the one that Odilon Redon is drawing, the one from Ovid. And that tale is silly. Polyphemus is made to look ridiculous in that
right.
painting, you know, and he's also ridiculous in the story. He agrees to stop drinking blood or something. stop her. If she'll leave her good-looking, her name is Galatea, I think, if she'll leave her good-looking boyfriend or
yeah.
boy that she's enamored with, then he'll give up all these nasty, monstrous things. And this poem actually, you know, when you read a line, the oral rinse of moral sense can lift the fence of, that's silly. When you have those three rhymes in there, the poet is conscious of some sort of playfulness creeping
yeah.
in.
But it's also almost like, to my mind or ear, it was almost like rap music,
yeah.
you know, where
yeah.
it was taking the kind of rhyme and, you know, and it's rhyming the violence of what's going on around all the time. I could hear that as a kind of rap music, which made a lot of sense to me.
Let's hear another poem by Anna Maria Hong. This one is called A Fable.
purveyor of rot and whatnot, entrepreneur of I forgot, with wrists hard as hammers that birthmark a slot, grip it, strip it, flip it hard, ramp my shard, if fear be sexy, a sink and a match, gone the way of wax and worms, gone like November 2011, sweet by nature, mean by culture. Goodbye, luck you idiot, said the fox to the grapes. I love you, replied the grapes.
That's much like the ending of the former poem, right?
Yeah.
Just, you know, used to nobody responding loud as circumstance, and this is the fox says, goodbye luck, he can't get the grapes. It's yeah. Goodbye luck, and circumstance says, oh, I love you as you walk away.
Well, it's a great rewriting or contribution to the story of the fox and the grapes, again, told in many, many ways. And what we usually think of that sort of Aesop fable version is where the fox tries, you know, jumps up, tries to get the grapes, and then because he can't reach them, decides the grapes weren't ripe anyway, so they would have been sour. I don't need any sour grapes. But here the grapes get the last word, which is surprisingly to the fox, I love you.
Yeah.
Of course, because the grapes weren't eaten.
Yeah.
That's a kind of...
Yeah. Well, this poem is a poem about love, sex, and sensuality, like Jamal Mays. You know, when I read Grip It, Strip It, Flip It Hard, I couldn't help but hear Whip It Good from right. Devo. Remember that song?
Yeah. Ramp My Shard.
Ramp My Shard, which is sort of nonsensical. I don't know how to read it except for ramp it up, or ramp up the fragment that I am or something, you know.
But again, the sounds are really marvelous.
And the curious thing is, the sounds are really obvious, self-conscious all the way through. If fear be sexy, a sink and a match, gone the way of wax and worm. And then you get this line, which is prosaic, gone like November 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I think what you're meant to realize is that there's a real kernel of sorrow in the midst of all this noise, right? All this sound.
Yeah, that something really does happen to you. Yeah. That actually what happens to you isn't a fable, but you end up having to think of what happens in terms of fables.
Yeah. Last month, to commemorate Ezra Pound's essay, A Few Don'ts by an Imagist, which came out 100 years ago in Poetry Magazine, we published a variety of don'ts by some contemporary poets.
And we have a few more this month by Sina Karius, William Logan, and Marjorie Perloff.
Marjorie Perloff is a celebrated scholar and critic with a particular interest in experimental poetry, both modern and postmodern. She joins us by phone today from California. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Chris.
Now, Marjorie, you say that Ezra Pound's essay is still the best roadmap, I'm quoting you here, still the best roadmap we have for understanding how poetry works. And one thing that's clear in his essay is that being a poet is hard work. Do you think it's actually too easy for people to call themselves poets these days?
I do. I really do. I think.
In what way?
You know, in order to write a novel, at least you have to make up a plot and have some length and so on. But yeah, I think these days, you know, everybody's a poet. I meet people all the time who some of them start writing poetry when they're 60 or even older, 70, and you have no compunction about, you know, that's fine, they can do it.
You quote some don'ts of Frank O'Hara at the beginning of your essay. Don't be bored, don't be lazy, don't be trivial, and don't be proud. The slightest loss of attention leads to death. And, you know, so many of us have read those words for years on end. And, you know, honestly, I never thought of them as Poundian till now. Do you think these really were Poundian?
I know. When I reread that, I thought that too. It's not that O'Hara liked Pound. It's obviously not a direct hint, but it is the same principle. But it would be really basically a modernist principle. So, you know, you could say that O'Hara, in that sense, came out of Williams or Stevens or Eliot, too. But it's the basic idea, which was the modernist notion, that poetry should be intense. There shouldn't be extra verbiage. I think he believed that very much, too. Not all this filler, not a lot of extra words. So I always cringe. Now, you can say it's easy for me to say because I'm not a poet, but I always cringe when I find sentences in poetry like the man who was going down the street, you know, where you have all these extra words that you really don't need. So the idea of it just sort of dragging on and on, you know, as many poems as when just when one picks up magazines have, I always wonder, well, why do the people even think of them as poems? I am not being facetious. I don't understand why they're called poems.
While you're clearing things up for us, the other question about that is what does O'Hara mean by don't be proud? Is he being ironic there?
Don't be proud. Well, don't take yourself so seriously. Mm. Don't be so self-important. And I think that was a great quality O'Hara had, that say Ashbery has. Don't think you have the view that you are the sage who knows, you know, what the meaning of life is, and be so pompous about it.
Do you see a contradiction between, say, well, I immediately think of Ezra Pound's line, here error is all in the not done, all in the diffidence that faltered. Do you see any contradiction between that, those lines, and don't be proud?
No, because it's all in the not done. If you can't do it, you know, the great line there in Pound is, do not retell in mediocre verse what has already been done in good prose. Now, even 100 years later, I don't think there ever could be a better admonition to poets than that. And it's quite true. If something can be said in prose, if you can write a magazine article about something, why turn it into a poem? There has to be a reason why it should be. And if not, then don't do it. That's like Wittgenstein's concept of what one cannot speak thereof must be silent. Don't do it unless it's worth doing, unless you feel you really can make it, really makes a difference to say X or Y.
You know, all these don'ts, it reminds me a bit of the, you know, it's like the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not.
I know.
Sort of negative proscriptions. And we were happy to see that you quote Vanessa Place, whose don'ts we published in last month's issue.
I know, that's right.
And she says, no more superiority of the interiority of that unnatural trinity, you, me, we, our teeth touch only our tongues. And she wrote her don'ts as a poem, but what do you make of those lines?
Our teeth touch only our tongues. And we're not, our teeth are not really, we're not grinding out something or biting into something that is unique. And the unnatural trinity, you, me, we, that it's such a great personal statement. People are always saying, and this is one thing I'm happy to have a chance to say on this podcast, that I am somehow the enemy of the lyric. That really is untrue, I think. I think certainly my favorite poets, after all, I worked on Yeats a lot, I worked on Goethe, all poets who are great lyric poets. I'm currently writing on Celan, Paul Celan, who was nothing if not a lyric poet. But I do think it is very hard today, in 2013, I'm not saying you can't write lyric. You can, and lyric also can be impersonal in certain ways, but it is very hard to make these so-called unique statements, because there are too many of them, and too many other people have said the same thing. And so the trinity of, I think, what Vanessa means there, although I don't totally agree with her either, the you, me, we, is that it's not interesting. I mean, you want to have something that is interesting and that stops you in your tracks in a way. And if it's going to be a poem about how you broke up with your boyfriend yesterday or whatever, it's not likely to be very interesting, because we have endless writing on that anyway, and endless video on it, and so forth. And so it is a different situation.
Well, let me go through just a few of your don'ts, and you call them extrapolations in the Pound tradition. This one, don't assume that free verse, now the default mode of poetry, is equivalent to the mere practice of lineation. What do you mean by that?
I take that very seriously. All right, just about everything one reads today is free verse. And most of what passes for free verse, it just means that the line breaks off somewhere. I don't know why. You can't explain it. It's not like William Carlos Williams, where there are reasons why lines break where they do. In Frank O'Hara, there are reasons why the lines break where they do. You can analyze it. You can just see what he's doing with the line break. But in most of the poetry you see, it's just straightforward, often written in straightforward sentences, and they're cut somewhere, and instead of being all the way to the right margin, they're lineated. Well, just sheer lineation doesn't make something poetry, I don't think. Sound has to be important, and the visual has to be important. A poem is always all three of those things, meaning, the visual, and sound. I would like to see poets pay much more attention to sound, and that might mean going back to certain metrical forms, sure. I think that would be a good thing. Now, I want to qualify there, though, and say that often people now today will say, I'm writing sonnets, which just means 14 lines and otherwise has none of the features of the sonnet, but it's 14 lines. But there's no rhyme scheme. There's no metrical scheme. Well, that's not very interesting. You know, so what? I mean, anybody can write a poem that has 14 lines. Stop after 14 lines. So I mean taking the words themselves and the phrases themselves and seeing how they balance. A great example of that would be Beckett. Another great example would be Gertrude Stein. It doesn't really matter whether it's written out as prose or written as poetry, but it's doing something with the sounds of the language, and that's what I mean by that don't.
You know, one of the most controversial, I think, of your don'ts is don't play the victim card, now the staple of much of what passes for poetry.
I'll get into trouble for that. I'm sure I'll get into trouble for that, but I say I do mean it, because you get the sense that I'm the only one who's suffering from what is happening in Afghanistan or Iraq and bombs falling, and there's no analysis. My ultimate political poem would still be, I guess, Yeats's Easter 1916. All change changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. And the idea of terrible beauty, things are not so, you know, these victim poems are always as if, ah, I am the victim. This was done to me. Well, nothing is done to us so completely. And all these things, well, all you have to do is say the word capitalism and we all cringe and, oh my God, capitalism. Well, what are these people doing that isn't, you know, that is outside of capitalism? I think that things have to be analyzed, whether in poetry or in prose, a lot more carefully. I'm a great fan of satire. I mean, 18th century satire, Swift and Pope, but also Orwell or 20th century satire. I think it's a very important mode, because the satirist has to deal with particulars. You have to deal with aberrations that you can show, like in The Rape of the Lock or in The Dunciad, and that, you know, are really convincing that way. But it has to be very specific. It has to be very particular. And so these poems about, here we are living in awful America, and here I am the victim, I find it very irritating and also very condescending in a way. It's always sort of assuming, because I'm a poet, I'm more sensitive than other people, and I know, and I'm suffering from the culture we live in.
Well, let me ask you one last thing, Margie, before we let you go. That, do you think these lines between experimental or avant-garde poetry and what mainstream poetry have broken down in the last decade or so?
I do. Yeah. I don't even like the word experimental. I never have. Because experimental always implies that it's a fail, can be is a failure. You know, well, I'm writing experimental poetry. Well, when you're 65, you're still writing experimental. But, you know, if there's something about it that's bothersome. Yes, I actually think, and I've actually written about that, where I took a poem by Ammons, A.R. Ammons, and by Denise Levertov, and I argued that the Donald Allen camp at that time, you know, loved Denise Levertov, and they had no truck with Ammons. And I put the two poems out, and they couldn't tell the difference. I said, which one is the avant-garde poem? And they certainly didn't, you know, they didn't know. And it was just that Ammons came out of a somewhat different tradition, although he certainly came out of the Williams tradition, too. And so he was not part of their coterie. So I do think what's going on today that I find unfortunate is that certain groups, let's say, well, language poetry is sort of over, but then post, I'm sure in that way, people are okay because they're part of our coterie, or not okay because they're not part of our coterie. And that's just a shortcut. It's a way of not really reading the poetry and seeing. And I don't think there are two camps at all. There are many, many camps, obviously. But I'm always surprised to see somebody coming out of, you know, an entirely different tradition that I think is excellent, or, you know, or the other way around. So I don't think that we should make hard and fast divisions anymore between, you know, the last thing is the school of quietude or whatever that was, and the post-avance. The very word post-avance means they're not very avant, you know. So, and on the other hand, I think it would be wonderful if, like in Pound's time, that was 1913, I think it would be wonderful if we did have some kind of revolution in poetry. By that I mean that I think we're due for a real change. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that change would involve. It would be wonderful if poetry did try to be, what shall I say, angry, a little bit angry in a way, and therefore do something new and not be so polite. I think one of the bad things today is that we're all too, I'm not, I guess, and so I get into trouble, but I do think most people are. They're so afraid that somebody will be angry at them and won't like their work that everybody's so polite to each other. You're not Christian, but anyway.
Oh, thank you, Marge.
I really like that. I don't think that people should be so polite. I mean, were Eliot and Pound polite? Eliot would write and say, you know, that Hamlet had its problems, or that he didn't think Milton worked as well as Dante did. You know, things of that sort, which of course are very extreme. But when you say extreme things like that, it forces people to reread and think about it. And I think it would be very useful if, as the modernists did in mid-century, people like Lowell did in the mid-century, people would be willing to say, I think this is awful. And I think this doesn't work, or I think this is, you know, the way to go. Even if you don't agree with them, it starts a conversation.
Well, thanks so much for all this, Marjorie. I'm going to politely say thanks so much for being with us today. This was great.
Thank you for having me.
You can read Marjorie Perloff's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the April 2013 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.